am T. Morris, the father of the patio book, the originator of the new delivery of fiction that you are listening to at this very moment. I am the uber nemesis of all podcast fiction authors.
And that means if you are ever in need of a personal assistant, someone to organize tour dates for you, or set up interviews, I'm the guy you want to call. Hey, here's my card. Let's do lunch. By the way, you're listening to episode 28 of Murder at Avedon Hill, written and hosted by P.G. Holyfield. And Mr. Holyfield, just so you know, the Avion chilled in the trailer waiting for you after the podcast. And you wanted to be reminded about Double Trouble happening on August 8th, 2008 at 8 o'clock a.m. Pacific Standard Time. Go to Amazon.com, order your copies of The Case of the Pitcher's Pendant, A Billabob Batting's Mystery, and Digital Magic. And if you need anything else, you have my number. I'm going to go and pick up the dry cleaning right now. Thank you, sir. It is a pleasure, as always, to work with you.
Welcome to the podcast presentation of Murder at Avedon Hill, The Chronicles of Aramis Cragan, written and produced by P.G. Holyfield. Hi everybody, P.G. Holyfield here, and welcome to episode 28 of Murder at Avedon Hill. Yes, you're not imagining things. This is a new episode. And released in 7 days. That's right, my friends. A week. What, you say? How can this be? Is the episode only 10 minutes long? Or is it that so long promised listener feedback episode? No, it is not only one chapter, but 2 chapters of the novel. Seriously. Okay, guys, well, seriously, I just had to get this episode out tonight because tomorrow, or today, if you download podcasts every morning, tomorrow is the oft-mentioned 8808 event, Double Trouble. T. Morris, Philippa Ballantyne, they're having their novels Billabob Battings and The Case of the Pitcher's Pendant and Digital Magic, respectively, released tomorrow at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on Amazon.com. We're here to rally the troops once more to show that the best podcast fiction authors deserve the followings they have and that podcast fiction is a viable marketing avenue. I'm so proud of T and Pip. They pimped their asses off the last 2 months and they've got 2 great novels to show for it, and I can't wait to see what the day brings us tomorrow. But now back to hopefully the reason you are here, and that is Murder at Avedon Hill. In addition to this episode, I'm going to be releasing the listener feedback show on Monday or Tuesday of next week, and then you'll be getting episode 29 of the novel before I leave for the beach next Saturday. When I get back from the beach, I will be releasing 1 more episode before DragonCon, and then after DragonCon, we're going to begin the stretch run. Weekly episodes. Bonus content. Story so far is from some great people, listener feedback at the end of each episode, and a new promo or two to get people to either come back or give the podcast a chance since we're finally hitting the home stretch. I'm really looking forward to it, and I hope you are too. To that end, anyone with questions or comments, please call the Karen line at 704-315-5884 or send me an email at pgholyfield@murderatavedonhill.com. So that we'll have some stuff to put at the end of each episode. Lately, I've had some interviews. One of the interviews was actually back in May. It's just got posted on tailchasing.com. There's another audio interview, which I will give the URL to once the file is available. He's got it posted, but it's not downloadable right now, so I'll wait till that gets fixed, and then I'll post that in the show notes. I've also had two print interviews, one at HollywoodJesus.com, and the other one I will put, it's at Susan Adair's website, and again, that URL will be in the show notes. Lastly, I just want to send a special thanks to the vicar from Geek Radio Daily for his work in this episode, doing the voice of Constable Lewis. He absolutely nailed it, and after today, you'll hopefully understand why I like Constable Lewis so much. Today's episode is chapters 27 and 28 of the novel. Again, I hope you enjoy it. See you next time. And now, episode 28 of Murder at Avedon Hill.
Chapter 27. The Out-of-Towner. The Icon of Treg, Child of Pain. The road that leads to your own truth is a warrior's path. Life and death lie on either side of you. Choose neither, and you follow in Treg's footsteps. Tales of the Children.
Aramis was so engrossed in his small journal that he barely noticed Constable Lewis's approach. He had made it back to the inn and was eating another meal in the common area.
Sir Aramis, I have some news.
Please, Constable, join me. Lewis sat down in the booth across from Aramis, but appeared uneasy.
I was just at the gate. Cletus told me a passing trader shared that he had found a horse tied to a tree along with its dead owner a few leagues west of here. The man said it looked like a vampire killing.
Aramis pushed his nearly full plate over to Constable Lewis. Here, eat. I need to get a few things, including Aaron. I take it you can lead us to the body.
Yes, but we need to hurry. There'll be Grosian patrols out, and if they get there first, well, there'll be nothing to see when we get there.
Horses.
They'll be waiting for us at the gate.
A psych later, Aramis Cragen, Constable Lewis, and Aaron approached the area where the tradesmen reportedly found the body. They had ridden in silence most of the way. Aaron had asked a question about Sarah Tremaine early on, which piqued Constable Lewis's interest. But all Aramis would say was, Miss Tremaine, luckily for everyone involved, is no longer a suspect in Greta Platt's murder. The look in Aramis's eyes had managed to silence Aaron's follow-up question, and a relieved Constable Lewis had urged his horse forward at a slightly quicker pace. They reached a crossroads where one could continue west towards the Grosh-Yew border, or south towards the Groshian city of Dolmentir. A far less traveled road branched to the north. Aramis pointed out that this trail led into western Inara. They continued west, eventually reaching a tight road nearly hidden by plant growth. The three men turned their horses down this path, proceeding southwest into a thickly wooded area. Soon thereafter, the men were forced to navigate past stretches of mud and puddles of water. Aaron was the first to spot the two sets of wheel ruts in the mud.
This is where the merchant said he found the body. He said he heard a horse struggling from the main road.
Aramis heard nothing but the breeze through the trees. I take it the trader took the horse with him. Lewis nodded. They led their horses down the narrow path. Eventually, they reached the point where the tracks of the trader's wagon ended. Aramis climbed down from his horse and studied the ground. Apparently, this is where the trader dismounted. We should proceed on foot from here. After securing their horses, they moved slowly forward until they reached an open meadow surrounded by trees. Aaron commented, "This might be a nice place to rest if it wasn't for that dead body over there." The corpse was in a sitting position, back against a tree, arms crossed over his chest. Once they moved in close, Aramis discerned that the body had been there only a few days at most. There were plenty of bugs and worms crawling around the body, but the face was still relatively recognizable. "Fortunately for us, it is winter and not summer." Aramis moved to his right to look at the left side of the man's neck. A jagged chunk of skin and flesh was missing. Blood had run down the man's neck and into his clothes, but far less blood than one would expect from such a wound. Aramis used a stick to move some hair that had matted against the corpse's neck. "Louis, does this resemble Greta's wound at all?"
"No, only the location of the wound is the same. Greta had two very distinct puncture wounds. This looks like something gnawed at his neck, and there's certainly more blood here."
"Aramis, could it be the moon beast?" Constable Louis raised an eyebrow at the reference, but remained silent. "I do not believe so. According to Father Joris, a single bite is not the mark of a moon beast, unless it is an attempt to only injure." Aramis waved his hand dismissively, having no desire to discuss theories how moon beasts spread their curse. Aramis's gesture had been understood by Aaron, but his simple acknowledgement of the possibility caused Louis to speak up.
"The moon beast? Are you saying that we're under threat by creatures other than vampires?"
Aramis responded, "Not to worry, Louis. We are only discussing what might have happened here, and an animal attack is certainly something to consider." Constable Louis did not appear satisfied with Aramis's answer, but didn't press the issue.
"The merchant said that he took nothing but the horse. I guess we'll never know if that's true."
"Aaron, go over there by that tree, the one with the rope around the trunk. I will assume that is where the horse was tied." Aramis pointed to the ground. "He was not killed right here." He pointed to the ground to the left of the body. "Not enough footprints here." The ground was soft under their feet. Aramis looked at the impressions near Lewis's feet and then back at the footprints near the corpse. "These footprints were not made by a heavy man." Aramis found deeper impressions on the other side of the corpse. "These footprints seemed to back away from the tree where the horse had been tied. I believe he was attacked by that tree and carried over to this one, and propped up like so."
"Why do that?"
"I do not know." Aramis began pulling at the man's cloak by the hem in order to get to the clothing underneath. "Judging by the lack of footprints, I do not believe the merchant disturbed the body." The man's tunic remained relatively dry. Underneath, Aramis found a scroll tube, connected to the tunic by a leather strap. Aramis opened the tube and pulled out a single piece of rolled parchment. Louis had been studying the ground between Aramis and Aaron, looking for anything out of the ordinary.
"What is it?"
Aramis ignored his query for the time being and pressed on the man's surcoat to see if there was anything underneath. He felt something on the man's chest. He reached behind the man's neck and found a chain. He pulled on the chain until a pendant came into view. Interesting. Aramis continued searching the corpse until he was satisfied he had not missed anything. He then stood and faced Louis.
"Something wrong, Aramis? You don't look well."
Aramis handed the parchment to the head constable. Louis read the name at the top of the page.
"Carlotta's Rare Books."
"It appears I need to speak to Lane Nichols."
"This was the man she was supposed to meet the night Greta was killed, isn't it?"
Aramis nodded. Aaron walked back over with a satchel. "I found this on the other side of the tree. The traitor must have missed it." Aramis took the bag and opened it. Within were several bound manuscripts, a few of which appeared to be very old. Exposure to the elements had already damaged them. As delicately as possible, Aramis reached inside and looked at each of the tomes. "What are you looking for?" Aramis threw the satchel over his shoulder and started back towards the horses. "Something that should have been in that bag." Constable Lewis called out to Aramis.
Shouldn't we do something with the body?
Aramis looked back. As you said before, Grotian patrols could be nearby. It would probably be best if we were not discovered burying a corpse. Constable Lewis and Darren looked at each other for a moment and then followed Aramis out of the grove.
Chapter 28, The Song of Artus, The Icon of Artus, The Child of War. The battle drums never played as loud as they did at Ulm that morning. Alicia Llewellyn's song had given them hope, a powerful magic indeed. Tales of the Children.
Aramis remained silent for most of the return trip. Constable Lewis led the way. Aramis just let his horse follow along without too much direction. Aaron rode by his mentor's side, carefully watching his actions. Aaron observed that Aramis spent most of his time studying the pendant he had taken from the book merchant's neck. Aaron couldn't quite make out what it was, but it appeared to be some sort of religious symbol. Finally, Aramis broke his concentration and looked over to Aaron. He dangled the pendant in front of Aaron so he could see it better. The symbol was of three swords set in a circle of silver. The center sword appeared to be surrounded by flames. Do you know what this is? It's a symbol I've seen before, but I can't recall from where. Aaron thought back to the conversations they had had over the last 2 days about the Children of Aj. Is that a symbol of Artus? Aramis smiled. Very good. You know, for an immortal that most people have forgotten, we sure have seen a lot of references to it lately. Yes, we have. As I said before, there are still those who worship Artus, at least in secret. They're usually men of war, not booksellers. Constable Lewis had been listening to the conversation. Aaron rode forward, pulling Aramis's mount along until the three men rode side by side, with Aaron in the middle. So, head constable, Aramis has been teaching me lately about the Children of Aj. Do you believe that the gods walk Cairn as mortals? Lewis didn't appear comfortable, but the look in Aramis's eyes prompted him to answer.
Aaron, I'm no scholar. I was not raised in Abaddon Hill, but in a similar town, where most citizens once held great regard for Artus and his works. By the time I became an adult, our temple to Artus had been rededicated to Iberian. When I came to Abaddon Hill, the temple to Artus was no longer being used, and it would be years before Father Joris would get a new temple built for the worship of Aj. Now there's a generation that barely knows who Artus was, or is.
Aramis asked, But what do you believe, Constable? Lewis still directed his comments to Aaron.
Aaron, have you ever heard the story of the Song of Artus?
Aramis smiled inwardly. The Song of Artus. Good. Once Aaron shook his head no, Lewis began telling the story.
The heroic Ironblade was the human general that destroyed the demon army of the city of Ulm during the War of Man.
Aaron interrupted. With the help of Queen Alicia and Iberian, right?
Yes, but it was the heroic's army that had delayed the demons for nearly 5 years. Thousands of men had died in the mountains of Inara and the plains of Yu just to make the final battle at Ulm possible. The heroic understood from the beginning that the demons were not just slipping into this world, they were organized and bent on the destruction of Cairn. It was Theoric's actions, his honor, his perseverance against all odds that made Alicia Llewellyn recognize Theoric's true nature.
Aaron's disbelief was evident. That Theoric was an incarnation of Artus. Lewis nodded.
It is said that her presence on the battlefield outside the walls of Ulm caused the heroic to realize his deific nature. And with that understanding came power, which ultimately allowed him to win the battle that day.
His epiphany. Why would the Elf Queen's presence unlock Theroic's memories and power?
Because some say that Queen Elysia Llewellyn was an incarnation of Iruna, the first daughter of Aj.
Oh, well, that makes all the sense in the world. But what does that have to do with the Song of Artus? Lewis looked past Aaron over to Aramis.
Where did you find this young man?
Alas, good parenting cannot overcome training by the Priest of Cairn. I am doing my best. Aaron wanted to protest, but he kept his composure, and Lewis continued.
On the battlefield that night, as corpses were being buried and demon carcasses were being burned, Queen Elysia began to sing. At first, she walked amongst the people doing their work, her voice barely above a whisper, but by the time she had finished, everyone, man, elf, and dwarf, within the sound of her now booming voice, surrounded her, enthralled. Her song praised the godlike effort by Theroic to preserve man against the demon threat, culminating with the victory over the demons on the battlefield that day.
Aramis broke in, continuing the story. Theroic and Dibirion were then called to the field, and stood side by side as she sang her song a second time. Queen Elysia changed the words as she went through it again, while it still raised the actions of Theroic to mythical proportions. The Elf Queen now sang of Artus, godchild of war. Do you know some of the song, Lewis?
Oh yes, Sir Aramis. It's one of the only poems I ever learned. I can't sing a note, but I can recite a little from the retelling if you like.
Aramis nodded, and Lewis began speaking in his light yet powerful voice.
Surrounding Artus, a living shield of man, Turim legions strove to break in vain. Shed no tears for Artus, Iberian shouted with pride. The wall still holds, he yet lives by our side. With weapons consecrated and with aid arrived before, on the vile Turim did his fatal sword thrusts pour. Then on Vernik and Vurlik did Artus cast his gaze as he charged upon his enemies like a cloud burst by the sun's rays. These and other mighty Carim on the earthly battle slain, by their valor and their virtue walk the bright ethereal plain. They have cast their mortal bodies, crossed the radiant portal of heaven, for to win celestial kingdoms unto mortals it is given. Let them strive by steadfast action, rousing speech endurance long, brighter life and holier future into sons of men belong.
Aramis remained silent during the song, allowing Lewis's voice to flow around them. Lewis's belief in Artus and his song was apparent. The power of the song brought tears to Aramis's eyes. Aaron was moved as well, turning on his horse to face Aramis, with a look of awe. I don't know what to say. Aramis composed himself. Thank you, Lewis. That was exactly what I needed right now. Lewis seemed to understand. He nodded and pulled his horse back a few paces, allowing Aramis and Aaron to ride on ahead. Aramis kept his voice low so the constable wouldn't hear. Aaron, I know the teachings you received from the Priests of Cairn were very specific when dealing with Artus. And by that I mean neglecting to include him as a child of Aj, giving credit to Arjun for some of the incarnations attributed to Artus, and so on. Of course, it is hard to fathom the idea that gods walk the land as mortals. Maybe it is hard for you to accept that there are gods at all. But as you have experienced over the last few days, there is a world beyond what you know. And if you want to survive, you need to better understand that world. Aramis continued at a normal volume. Theroic was a great general, possibly the greatest general in our race's history. The followers of Iberian had their reasons to discredit Theroic's legacy, but what they did in raising Iberian to immortal status at the expense of Artus was wrong. And I am not saying that Iberian was not a child of Aj. There are various legends of prophets during Cairn's history that lead me to believe there's merit to the idea that some of these prophets were incarnations of the same immortal being. But to deny the existence of the immortal that defines action and war is problematic at best.
As be praised. I've heard that your opinions have caused some trouble for you in the past, Sir Aramis.
Aramis smiled. Yes. One problem that the Priests of Cairn has with the Aaronic Brotherhood, though we are not a religious entity, is that we refuse to acknowledge this change in Aja's family tree. I admit I have been one of the louder voices of disagreement with the followers of Iberian. Aramis moved his horse forward and left the other two men behind. Aaron and Lewis realized the conversation for Aramis was over.
My name is Myrrh Lafferty, and last winter my superhero novel, Playing for Keeps, was the first book to be delivered via audio and PDF podcast at the same time. 20,000 people have enjoyed this novel, and now it's coming out in print. Playing for Keeps will be published by Swarm Press this August 25th. Many of you helped this book become one of the most popular in podcast history, and I'd like your help again. I need to make a splash on Amazon to push my book up the charts and get more exposure. So I'm asking you to head to Amazon on August 25th to purchase Playing for Keeps. Don't think that since I'm hitting print, I'm forsaking the podcasting. During the month of August, I'll be celebrating the print release of Playing for Keeps with several treats. I'm reawakening stories of the third wave, bringing you content connected to the world of Playing for Keeps from hot names in podcasting, like Christopher Lester, Casey Schultz, Matthew Wayne Selznick, J.C. Hutchins, and Matt Wallace, just to name a few. I'm holding a video contest for the song Playing for Keeps, where contestants can win Swarm books, Beatnik Turtle CDs, or a flip video camera. Close to the launch of the book, I'll be re-releasing the PDF, along with all the original comic book art, styled by Jared Axelrod and Natalie Metzger, and an exclusive can't-find-anywhere-else short story called Parasite Awakens. And on the day of, the day when we do our assault on Amazon and make you all heroes of the 25th, you'll have frequent video updates from me letting you know how the book is doing and perhaps some messages from other podcasters. It should be very amusing. So go now to playingforkeepsnovel.com right now and subscribe to get the new content, the PDFs, and the video updates. And remember to go to amazon.com on August 25th to purchase the book. I can't do it without you.
Hi, this is Scott, a.k.a. Spiritual Tramp, author of the podcast novel Archangel, which can be found at www.archangelnovel.com. I was listening to a podcast a while back, I forget which one, and Nobilis came on with a PSA, that's Podcasting Service Announcement. He said that since podcasters like you,
P.G. Holyfield,
don't get paid to do this, and since you all thrive on attention, and that we as listeners should go out of our way to send emails, audio content, phone calls, whatever we could, to encourage the podcasters we enjoy. He said to think of it like paying our bills, so that's what I'm doing. When I think of quality podcasts, the name of
P.G. Holyfield
comes to mind, and I just want to thank you for your hard work.
You've been listening to Murder at Avedon Hill, a podcast novel written and produced by P.G. Holyfield. Please visit pgholyfield.com for more information on this novel and the author. Most of the music in this podcast generously provided by Shira Common through Magnatune.com. Magnatune.com, they are not evil. Additional music generously provided by Kevin MacLeod through his website at incompetech.com. Be sure to check out Murder at Avedon Hill at podiobooks.com, and if you are so inclined, please post a review at iTunes, at Podcast Pickle, or at podiobooks.com. Audio comments about the podcast can be left on the Cairn line at 704-315-5884, or go to pgholyfield.com and click on the Call Me button to leave comments. This podcast is copyright 2007-2008 by P.G. Holyfield and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 U.S. license.